And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
In my experience, labor people are incredibly practical and will try to reach an agreement that they can live with rather than the best possible agreement.
We're back. Did you miss us? I'm Evan Drellick, senior baseball writer for The Athletic. Welcome back to our labor show that we do every Wednesday, typically, on The Athletic Baseball Show. Last week, we did it on Friday. It's kind of an emergency pod right after the lockout. This week, we're back at our regularly scheduled time. I don't come bearing a lot of news or even particularly good news. The update is there really isn't an update. The latest I have is that we don't know yet, and the parties don't know yet, when they're going to start talking again. They haven't formally scheduled a date. It's not surprising. After the meetings in Dallas last week, they basically retreat to their corners, you know, I guess take a shower, take a breather for 2 minutes, regroup, get their positions and strategies together, and then the bargaining will pick up. But I think it was apparent that they weren't going to get a deal done in December, and I don't think that's changed. I'm not a betting man, but I would not bet on a deal getting done this month. I think January will be quite intense leading up to the start of spring training, or at least the expected start of spring training in February. We've got a two-prong episode for you this week. First up is Andy McCullough, one of our national writers, a feature writer extraordinaire, who just had some questions for me that he wanted to ask, and we thought, why not? Let's just go through it, Andy. You have that privilege if you want to get some things off your chest and go through how this is all working as best that I can explain it. So that's the first segment. And then we've got Dave Leach, who is a professor, an adjunct professor at Brooklyn Law School. And he's now retired, but he spent 45 years at the National Labor Relations Board. So somebody who very much knows the ins and outs of collective bargaining and how the NLRB works. So if you have an interest, even if you don't have an interest, in the more technical side of this and what the function of the NLRB is, it's a particularly good listen. Before we go there, I wanted to quickly go over a little bit of sound from last week. You know, Rob Manfred spoke for about 10 minutes. Tony Clark and Bruce Meyer of the Players Union spoke for a little bit longer in their own press conference. There's a lot we didn't use in last week's episode. One thing that sticks out to me is a conversation that's kind of ongoing about how much these sides like each other, and then within that, how much does that matter? So here's Rob Manfred speaking first, and then we've got Tony Clark, and both of them are addressing this topic.
The whole relationship issue, I think people put way too much emphasis on that issue. At the end of the day, it's about the substance. We're here, they're there, we need to find a way to bridge the gap.
I think it's overstated. Well, I say that because fundamentally, the interests of management don't often track the interests of the union. And so there are inherent friction points that are part of the relationship anyway. The last 2 years have been challenging for all involved, fans, the game, both sides of the equation. And so I think it makes for a nice headline, but at the end of the day, a deal is going to get done and the game and the industry is going to move forward. There may be differences of opinion along the way. Those differences of opinion may manifest themselves behind closed doors. They may manifest themselves in public. But MLB represents the clubs. We represent the players. And as a part of that equation, we will continue to work together and move the industry forward.
So the first thing I try to do whenever basically I hear anything from either side is try to figure out, all right, what's the self-interest here? Should we accept or could we accept possibly what they're saying on face value? I do think it is in their self-interest, both sides' self-interest, to paint their relationship as functional. And I don't think that point should be ignored. However, in my evaluation, I think what they're saying is probably right. I don't look at what they're saying and hear it and go, you know what, I think they're lying. The relationship between the players and the owners has undoubtedly been chippy and rancorous at times. You saw it even get ratcheted up a little bit last week when you have Manfred with his press conference and Tony Clark and Bruce Meyer with theirs, and both sides saying it's the other who's screwing this up. It's probably important to remember, though, that it's not supposed to be perpetual harmony. That's not the way this system is designed. Now, even within that, so if you kind of accept the baseline that, yeah, no, they're not always going to get along. It's a management group, and it's a labor group, and they're self-interested parties, and they're representing their own interest. Even within that, it is certainly possible that the relationship can get to a point where you go, oh, this is no good. Bad. And at times, it's probably been there. If you think back to 2020 and the effort to restart baseball from the pandemic, you had letters flying back and forth, and some of those letters were published in The Athletic. You know, the league sending a letter to the union sending a letter back. Just a lot of public sniping. It's not good. Now, they were, at the end of the day, they didn't actually get to an agreement last year. They did end up playing baseball, so the result was still there. There is a grievance pending from that quarrel, that squabble last year over how many games the season should have been and all this. I think it is important to remember as you go through it, as you hear things throughout this lockout, that it's not designed, it's not a system that's designed to always be happy. And even if they are being negative, it doesn't necessarily mean things aren't working as they're supposed to. There's this kind of like default position for people that, well, why can't they just get along? Because the system isn't designed for them to get along. It would be odd if they were always getting along. And then you just hedge on that and say, but, you know, it can also get to a point where it's really not good, you know, and we'll see if it does get there. We've still got a little bit of time. All right, here's Andy McCullough and his role reversal with me. I'm going to be his interviewee. So I'm going to hand over the keys for this segment. Andy McCullough of the New York Star-Ledger, famously, is joining us. And he used to host his own show here, and he did something in the playoffs where he was hosting again. So he knows how to host. But he texted me the other day and said that he wants to get to the bottom of this lockout thing, and he's got questions for me. So apparently, you know, because I have all the answers, I guess, he's just going to grill me for some amount of time. I have not seen the questions, so I might not have answers for the questions. But Andy, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Evan. I feel like you and I have a lot in common, as I have hosted three separate podcasts for The Athletic, which have all been canceled. And, you know, you famously got fired.
Not from radio.
All right.
I actually turned down a radio job to join The Athletic.
Wow, that's
fun fact.
Wow, man, what a
voice like this. Yeah.
We should play the song. I need to record the. Anyway, all right. We'll get into this. All right, I have questions. Why are the players on strike?
Well, they're not on strike. It's a lockout.
A lockout? What's a lockout?
Well, a lockout is kind of the management equivalent of a strike. So the National Labor Relations Act codifies these two tools that you can use. One is for the employer, and one is for the employee. And so this is the employer taking an action to say, you can't show up to work, players. We're not running the business until we get a new collective bargaining agreement. And you can't have a strike or a lockout, at least legally, when you have a CBA in force. How's that?
What did you tell your family at Thanksgiving is happening?
Oh, that, you presume I speak to my family at Thanksgiving. No, oh, I did. Geez. I actually had a lovely
It's getting darker and darker.
I don't think we really talked about the lockout at Thanksgiving. You know, we talked about life and non-baseball things. So no, I didn't tell them anything about it.
All right. Why won't anyone in baseball return my calls?
Maybe you've written too many mean things about too many baseball players. Maybe the Bill Plaschke wannabe stuff. I don't know.
All right. What? Okay. So we got a lockout, right? The owners put it in. What is happening right now? Is there anything going on? There's no discussion. And what's happening?
Strategery.
What is strategic about this?
They are strategizing now. So they were meeting in Dallas. Remember last week they had the final bargaining sessions leading up to the expiration of the CBA. It expired. They didn't have a deal. So now they go back to their corners. They go back to their offices. They go back and have meetings, and they reset. And I don't know when they're actually going to start talking. The latest I have, and I've already said it in the intro to this, is that they don't have anything scheduled. So they'll probably start having some conversations this month, but I don't think anything's going to pick up incredibly soon. You know, strap yourself in, love. It's going to be a while.
So they're just sitting. They're not doing anything.
Right now, no, right. They are not, you know, locked in a room in heated bargaining talks right now. No, they are preparing and planning for the bargaining talks to resume.
Is this necessary?
Is it necessary? Well, the players would tell you that the lockout was not necessary, that it was a conscious choice by management, which it indeed was. But management, the commissioner's office, Rob Manfred, would tell you they needed to do this because, they think it has the best chance of having the season be uninterrupted, that if you make this move now, you kind of exert pressure to force everybody to get a deal done. You know, Tony Clark batted back against that idea, said it was a provocative thing for players. So players don't like being locked out. It's not something you want. So necessary depends who you ask.
I don't get it.
What don't you get?
Well, what pressure are the players feeling right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of the crux of it, is there isn't pressure until money starts to flow. They don't get paid, as you know, during the off season. Their paychecks are during the regular season. And so That's why this might end up waiting until, you know, the start of spring training. And then the question is, do they actually have it done to start spring training and on time? Do we have to miss some of spring training? But yeah, the real pressure point is once you arrive at a point when you're missing, you know, some work event, and the work event, you know, no offense to the winter meetings, no skin off anybody's back. It's really once games start to be played, even spring training games, that it matters.
But wouldn't it be better for the sport if they were like sitting together trying to work this out?
Yeah, no, they. I was talking to somebody involved. I won't reveal who, but who was saying they love when writers will write. They need to just lock themselves in a room and hammer it out. Yeah, theoretically that'd be great if they were just doing marathon bargaining. But that's clearly not how it works. They're not, you know, they've got to. Well, I think when you're this far apart, you do have to kind of. There's a lot of going back and discussing with, all right, well, do we want to move on here? Like when you kind of get to the point, and I'm speculating here. Nobody's explained this nitty gritty to me, but this is what my gut instinct says. When you have a general agreement and say, all right, we're going to go in this area, and you got to work out like one term of it, you know, I don't know. Let's say you were working out the league minimum. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Is it 600,000? Is it 650,000? Is it 580,000? Whatever the number is. You know, then, yeah, okay, you could probably lock yourself in the room and you're not leaving until you find that number. But the concepts are so far apart at this point that, you know, you can sit in a room, I guess, and do it. But I think that waits until, A, there's more pressure, like if there were games approaching, and B, until you have a little bit more general direction, which they don't really have at this point. You look confused.
Yeah, I just... well, there's so many interesting things you said, Evan. You've done just such a good job covering this that, you know, I feel like I'm learning so much. I like it when rich people tell you you're an idiot because you don't understand how things work. That's always fun when we do that.
They tell me that.
Well, they tell me that too all the time. Yeah. I mean, that's every conversation I've ever had with like a really good player. No, that's not true.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay. What do the owners want?
You know, it's actually, I'm not complaining, a little bit complaining. I had my hand up to ask one more question at Rob Manfred's press conference in Dallas, and that was going to be the question: was what besides getting a deal done? What are the actual objectives here? And I don't think they would have outlined much because neither side wants to give away too much as far as specific positions go. But the general understanding is the league is pretty happy with the status quo. They don't mind where it is.
Yeah.
And they would like to keep it relatively close to where it is. And actually, we can throw to some sound here real quick here of a question I asked to Bruce Meyer, the union's lead negotiator, about what specifically do the players want? And you can hear that they're not going to specify it for you.
We haven't drawn those kinds of lines in the sand. We've made proposals. We've maintained certain proposals. Proposals that we believe are important, but you know we're willing to talk about anything. And one of the frustrating things this week was the league would tell us why they didn't like our proposals, and we'd said, okay, well make a counterproposal, make your own proposal, and they did. We have decisively rejected certain of their proposals, which we believe will actually make the system worse for players. I mean, our objective obviously is to change the system in a number of different areas to address concerns that we have. To date, the proposals the league has made, in our view, taken as a whole, would make the system worse. So going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Wow. It's interesting, actually. I was able to get my hand up and ask a question and commit an act of journalism.
I asked multiple questions
last week, and I actually asked Steve Cohen, if he agreed with Scott Boras and Max Scherzer, his new pitcher's contention, that teams need to be incentivized to compete. And he told me that he was deferring comment to Rob Manfred. So
yes,
you really shouldn't have been dragging ass at that press conference, and you actually should have committed an act of journalism.
I think I asked at least 3 or 4 questions.
Yeah.
We have the audio.
So, okay. So the owners like this deal, right? Like the general perception, right, is that in 2011 and 2016, probably 2016 specifically, the owners won the negotiations and the terms of the deal are favorable to them.
Correct.
Right. So like when you talk about the gulf between the two sides, mm-hmm. It's really what the players want to change.
Correct.
Now, the way that I'm not an attorney, but I did purchase an LSAT prep book last year when I was considering a career change, and I discovered that I would not do well enough to get into a law school.
Not yet. Keep trying.
Yeah, that's true. My understanding of how these things work, right, is that the players have to give something up in order to get something back that they've already negotiated away. Because all the things that they seem to dislike, you know, the CBT, the qualifying offer, etc., were not, like, codified in the rule book 100 years ago. It's stuff that they negotiated for in the last decade. What do they have to give back in order to get the things that they want?
Yes, you hit on a very interesting part of this, and it's something that I don't know that I quite wrapped my little pea brain around for some time. In bargaining, it's not always about horse trading. Like, yes, the players can agree to an expanded postseason, and that will provide some more money that the owners want, and so that's something the players can trade. But if you look over time, in collective bargaining, not even just in baseball, what often brings about major change is the power to say, I'm not going to go to work. This is not a fair deal. And unless you change it, we're not going to have a deal. And so, you know, the notion of, well, the players would have to have something to give. They've actually been pretty public about the deal needs to, in their opinion, needs to swing in their direction. If you look at the major changes, it's often the case that there hasn't been some great give back, because if it was that way, you would never really see movement in one direction. It would always kind of be, if you were looking at a percentage basis of revenue, then it's always just going to be moving money around, you know, instead of, if players had 55% of money or 50%. It would always stay the same, but that hasn't been the case, right? Throughout time, it's moved in different directions. So, yeah, horse trading is important, but I think when it comes to big issues, it's really, are you willing to plant your flag and say, nope, we're not doing this. You got to change this.
Right. So what the players have to offer, or what the players have, right, is the ability to withhold their labor.
Correct.
And that's the thing that they would have. That's the cudgel they have, per se.
It's a cudgel on both sides. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay. Right. Right. But the owners also, like, they have the upper hand because they have a good deal. The last deal was good. Like, so the things that the owners would want to keep, they already have. They already have, right? They like the CBT. They like the qualifying offer. They like, you know, destroying the draft for no reason. They like the minor league reduction. They like all these things, right?
Sure.
What the players want are things that they need to change.
Yes.
And the thing the players have in order to enact that change is withholding their labor, right?
That's right. That's the right way
to think. So why does everyone say, all the, you know, you guys who, you know, and we'll cut to a clip from our pal Jason Stark after this, who can outline what your life is going to be like this winter. Why does everyone say that there's not going to be games missed?
Because there's so much money on the line and nobody wants to not make money. And so the impetus is to get something done such that, you're not sacrificing the millions of dollars that come into a stadium on a nightly basis. That's the operating logic. But by the way, if you sit there and go, I don't think they're going to get this done in time to play a full season, I think it's a relatively low percentage, but it's certainly above a non-zero chance that happens. You know, if they played 154 games, if they played 140 games, at this point, anything is in the realm of possibility. It would be pretty stunning to me if they missed, you know, a season or even a real significant chunk of it, particularly at this point where you don't have, and I've said this on multiple podcasts, and maybe at some point they'll identify it. You don't have that one issue that you can look at and go, this is what they're somebody needs to give me a better phrase. I don't like involving death, but this is the hill they are going to die on. And we don't know what either side's hill of death is at this point.
Speaking of men dying on hills, let's go to that clip from Jason.
We'd be sitting there waiting for Don Fehr and Bud Selig and a bunch of owners to come out and accuse each other of all sorts of dastardly stuff. And all I could think was, when do I get my life back? When do I get to be joyous? When do I get to hug my loved ones? How did I get here? How do I get out of here? guess.
So there was no holiday cheer in those moments there?
No, there was not. And so luckily now that is Evan Drellick's job to provide us with the play-by-play until this thing ends. So I just want to say this. Evan, you're my hero, man, for many reasons, but especially this reason. Good luck to you. Have a joyous holiday season.
That was Jason Stark talking about the 1994 labor negotiations on Tuesdays at the Athletic Baseball Show.
Yeah, I'm stressed. This happened. What time is it now? Within the hour. So right before we were recording, I messaged our boss Emma Spann and said, basically, I'm cooked here. Unless there's breaking news, like, just, you know, pretend I don't exist.
What are you cooked with? There's nothing happening.
Well, I've a lot of travel since the middle of the playoffs. It's been just the travel adds up. I got laundry. You want to come over and help me out with the laundry?
No,
you
know? I'm not. I'm not going to Queens. No. Okay. You had to get on a plane to cover the World Series, and then you had to go to Dallas or something.
It's tiring. The whole thing is tiring. You know, the covering of labor is while I intellectually enjoy it as I try to get my head around it. You know, you're constantly stressing over every sentence and filtering things, and it's so many little details. It's like an act of reporting. You know, it's a little different than you stand there and, Mr. Coach, you know, how do you feel about the win today? It's, you know, it can be stressful.
Is it just because Mr. Coaches liked you that you like doing this?
There's a couple who did. Yeah. I don't know. Do the people in labor like me now? You know, I this is not a line of work you get into to be loved, as I've well learned. You know, when everybody loves you, you'll never be lonely, as Adam Durrett said.
That's depressing. Okay. All right. So what's going to happen is the owners are kind of going to crack.
It would be. I think shocking if the players did not achieve some of what they want. And it would be also shocking if the players achieved all of what they want. The presumed outcome for me, and I think for most people, is it will move somewhat in the players' direction. And the question is how much and, you know, in what issues, right? Is it only the luxury tax thresholds that go up? Is it only the league minimum that goes up? Or do they... you know, add something of, I think, what I would consider probably a more significant gain. And it would really depend how much you expand arbitration, right? If are you just expanding the Super 2 class? You know, but thus far, MLB is saying you're not touching revenue sharing and you're not touching time to free agency and you're not touching arbitration. That's according to Bruce Meyer, the union negotiator.
Right. But they will probably be like, yeah, you want a little bit more on the big league minimum. Okay, fine. Want to make the CBT go up higher. You know, I wrote about this last year. Like, it's not that teams were wary of going over the CBT. They're not even approaching it.
Right.
Like they're not even – it's not that they're, like, getting to within $5 million and holding the line. They're $25 million, $30 million away. The overwhelming majority. There's only a couple teams who even come close to it every year, let alone surpass it.
Well, that's why it's kind of an issue. Like, what the union explains is that it really is a set of mechanisms that they think can achieve change, right? And so, you know, whereas I say, what is that single issue, the hill to die on topic? They do see it as you move the CBT, you address tanking. You potentially address draft pick compensation, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're signing a player, do you have to give up a draft pick or not? And MLB, you know, is within a package, so you can't isolate the elements necessarily, but they've shown a willingness to talk about getting rid of draft pick compensation. So you're right. Just moving the CBT, well, what does that necessarily do? They think in a totality of the things they want, they could get to a place where there's effectively more money coming to their membership. And that is their goal.
All right. I think I get it now.
It's a lockout, not a strike. You understand that?
Yes, I do understand that, okay. Evan. That was setting you up to explain what a lockout
is. Oh, I see. That was audio comedic stuff. Got it. Understood. purposeful. Intentional.
Also, I think everyone in baseball is not returning my calls because there's like a media blackout. Or it's what you said, that none of them like me.
Oh, right. Yeah, they said you can't talk to people.
Yeah, you can't talk to anyone. So
Yeah, people will still talk.
Maybe to you.
To some people.
Yeah. To Ken Rosenthal. Yeah.
That's right. Our captain. Yeah. Well, this is great. So I passed the test. I passed the audition.
I don't care. Okay. Now I can go back to shuffling my poker chips.
Yeah, you're the host. You got to thank me for joining you.
Yeah, good. Evan, thank you for joining me on the latest edition of Labor of Love, or whatever it is you're calling this podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Andy. Dave, thanks so much for making some time to join us. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Evan. Thanks for asking me to join you.
So you spent 40 years at the National Labor Relations Board, and I want to hear about your work there and what the NLRB does. But before we get to that, has baseball been a part of your life? Are you a baseball fan?
Yeah, you know, ever since my Uncle Ray took me to a Major League Baseball game in one of the last games at Ebbets Field before they shut down, and walked out as a kid into the open, part behind the stadium and seeing it. You know, you were hooked from that point on. But yeah, baseball has been a great fan.
Can you explain to people who might not have much familiarity with the NLRB what it does, what its purpose is, how it operates? I know there's regional offices, and you became a regional director, but the basic crash course in the NLRB's function.
Yeah, sure. Back in 1935, Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act. It is a law that provides workers with the basic right to join, form, or support a union. They have the right to bargain collectively through unions that they choose. And they have the right to engage in concerted activity for mutual aid and protection, including striking, to get better position. If you go back in history to Samuel Gompers, he said that unionization, when he formed the AFL-CIO back in 1886, he said that unions, substitute collective strength for individual's weakness. So collective bargaining has been the answer. Back in 1935, when the laws had no say in any strikes, they couldn't decide the issues. They tried enjoining. They tried to, police tried arresting people who tried to organize and picket. And finally, the act was passed just to give workers those basic rights to join, form, and support a union. The statute, in Section 7, which gives those rights, says employees have the rights. So employers don't have those rights. The unions don't have those rights. These are rights of workers to decide for themselves whether they want representation. In 1935, the day he signed the law into law, Franklin Roosevelt said, "This statute is at its heart an enforcement statute to enforce the rights under Section 7.
Got it. So in your role as a regional director and as prior to that, what was the task? Was it investigative mostly? Is it following through on complaints and charges?
Yeah, it's a very interesting agency. It's divided into two parts, with only six people being political appointees. There is the board, the quasi-adjudicative body that has the role of deciding disputes, cases that are brought to the board. And they're all presidential appointees confirmed by the Senate. Then there's the general counsel side. The general counsel is basically the person who can investigate charges and decide which cases should be brought before the board. So regional directors in the regional offices, and there are 26 of them around the country, where a regional director with delegated authority from the general counsel will investigate any claims of unfair labor practices. And once they investigate the case, we'll determine whether or not to issue a complaint to litigate the case before an administrative law judge who works for the board, and then that case could go from the judge to the board, or whether to dismiss the case.
Well, so you're teaching now. You're no longer at the NLRB.
Yes.
Do you have any reaction when you hear MLB is in a lockout? Do you start to follow it more?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think all of us start to follow baseball, those of us who are fans. We kept hearing, something was going to happen. Most likely there would be a lockout. Yeah. And that is an interesting issue because the contract expired December 1st. So for a union to decide whether or not, to put economic pressure to help their bargaining, which is really all they can do. I mean, if the statute says the employer doesn't have to agree to anything, a union has to have some weapons. And that's what the courts call them. Anything a union does, including the right to strike, is considered a weapon. And the Supreme Court has said the courts will not weigh in on what those weapons are. Employers also have some weapons. If the workers go out on strike and they're economic strikers to put pressure on the employer, the workers can be permanently replaced.
Right.
Which is interesting. They can't be fired for joining the union, but if the union goes on strike and they call a strike to put pressure on the employer, they can all be permanently replaced. Though they retain the rights to reinstatement for a period of time, it's daunting. So the employer has some weapons too. One of the weapons when you think about a lockout, is that it's the employer's option to a strike. They can't strike, but they can lock out the workers. The employer had the same kind of weapon the unions did. So the only kind of limitations on an employer in terms of locking out, they can't lock someone out in support of an unlawful premise. Like they're asking for a subject in the bargaining that is not a mandatory subject of bargaining. They can't lock out to enforce that. But other than that, they can do that. The Supreme Court specifically said a union is not losing anything by a lockout because all they've lost is the timing of the strike. They still have a right to strike. And the lockout, in essence, is the employer's weapon. Interestingly, in a lockout, the employer can't permanently replace the workers. Like an employer who has faced a strike.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
What should people watch for during a lockout? What are the things that can happen? Obviously, they'll continue bargaining,
right?
But are there other things that the public should be aware of? Impasse is one thing I wouldn't mind you explaining, but if there's anything else as well that you think is worth mentioning.
Yeah, the lockout and the strike, and even the impasse, which I'll talk about in a minute, you know, are really not the end of bargaining. An impasse is the right of an employer who has to bargain in good faith, but not forever. Marathon bargaining is not required. They just have to bargain in good faith. And good faith you would define as a present intention to reach an agreement. You know, so if you go into a, you know, to buy a car, you know, you have people bargaining and, you know, about the price, well, hopefully you're going to reach an agreement. Yeah. But in labor law, you know, it's not always the case that an employer really wants to reach an agreement. They could be at the bargaining table and going through bargaining on the surface. They could be just bargaining enough just to make it look like they're trying. So cases can be filed with the regional director and an investigation will be made as to how the bargaining has been going. So impasse is just one tool that the employer can say, look, I bargained in good faith. I can't go any further. You know, I've agreed to all that I want to agree to and all that I can to remain competitive, or any other reason. They're saying, like, this is it. This is as far as I can go. In my experience, labor people are incredibly practical and will try to reach an agreement that they can live with rather than the best possible agreement. And try to to work out a deal that deals with each side's interests. So that's what I would be hoping for in this is that nothing stops during the impasse. You can continue to bargain or try to resume bargaining because the implementation has just set terms, which the employer is free to do. Same thing with the lockout. You know, the parties will continue to bargain. Hopefully, as they've done in the past, the people will be able to see that the parties have reached an agreement and spring training can start. And those of us who are Met fans can say, the haul that we've gotten in free agency, you know, we might be able to see something on the field. And this might be the year where we turn it around.
You got to believe. So it's the case that impasse is something that the union, the players' union, would be trying to avoid, right?
Correct.
My understanding is that the function of the NLRB can be influenced by the current administration, whoever's in office at the time. And therefore, because there's a Democratic president, the players, if there were a case or a charge that would be moved by the NLRB, would be something of a benefit to players. Is there anything you can elaborate on there? Just how the what is the political element of the NLRB?
Yeah, it's become more significant over time. When I first started the board in 1976, a number of the board members were folks who never represented a party, either a union or a management. John Fanning was a director of labor relations for the Department of Defense, became a board member for 25 years. That's five-year terms. Professor Howard Jenkins from Howard University became a Republican appointee to the board, served 20 years. And oftentimes the Democrat Fanning and the Republican appointee would join in a dissent. It's during the 80s when we started to see more politicization of the appointments where people were more anxious to change policy. It used to be the board would only change policy when, industrial necessities, changes in the industry required, some modification of a board's, theories on finding violations of the law. And then in the last, 30 years now, going back to the 80s, every political change has led to the president appointing a majority. The statute doesn't say, that there has to be a majority of any side, but by congressional agreement, the president can appoint three members of the board, and the opposite party can appoint two. So it's always a 3-2 decision. There are 5-year terms over 5 years. It's one board member comes due every year. So the Biden administration was just able to appoint two board members to vacancies that gave them a 3-2 majority. So there will be a more pro-worker board that will be looking at appeals.
Right, right. Last thing. Sports cases seem to have, we could say millionaires versus billionaires. People don't like that. People who are involved don't like that dismissive attitude toward it. But I do think there's a segment of the public who sees that. As someone who worked on the ground here, how do sports cases fit in overall? Do they impact what happens in outside industry? Are they, should they be looked at as equivalent to others? How do they fit into the landscape?
That's a really great question, Evan. I mean, every case that you handle where workers have been fired, it doesn't get published. Right. People don't see that. They get fired because they tried to form a union. But when Sam McCollum from the Seattle Seahawks, who was a player rep during the 1982 strikes, so it goes back in history. He got discharged because he led a dispute before games, a protest before each game with a handshake where both teams met at midfield and shook hands, which you never saw, right? Because, the whole thing was, enemy armies are going after each other. And that's a whole idea of the NFL, taking grand and militaristic kind of view. But to show the players showing solidarity led to the discharge of Sam McCollum, the Seattle Seahawk wide receiver. I got to litigate that case. I got such incredible publicity, sitting in Seattle, because they sent me from New York out to Seattle to try the case. I was having breakfast, and the waitress comes up and she said, "I saw you on TV," because the administrative law judge had allowed the opening statements of the trial to be televised. It got a lot of publicity. I was in the New York Times for that case, and I also wrote the umpire's decision when Richie Phillips's union was decertified. I was in the New York Times sports section for 3 consecutive days. Wow. I had always hoped it had been for being center fielder for the for the Mets, but I made the sports. But those cases get publicity, and people learn about the act, and they learn about the law, and they learn about the rights that everyone has under the National Labor Relations Act. So it is something that people complain about, that why are only those cases publicized? But it's a reality. More people are interested in. I think from this, people are going to learn labor law.
Yeah.
I'm hoping you take my labor law class at Brooklyn Law School.
You know what? We might have to make that happen.
If there's any more,
it might be time. If you're offering, we should look into that.
Every fall, I teach the Labor Law 1 class, which takes you from the beginning of the history of the act being enacted until the current days and through all of the changes in case law. In the spring, I teach a collective bargaining seminar. I'm sure you could come in and audit the class anytime you want.
There we go. Right, live on the Athletic Baseball Show. We've got my next career move lined up. Going to go to law school with Dave. Dave, thank you so much for A, the offer, but B, for taking some time with us. I really do appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure, Evan. Thanks so much.
An oft-repeated reminder that you can save 33% off an annual subscription to The Athletic by going to theathletic.com/baseballshow. Thanks to Andy. Thanks to Dave. Thanks to you for listening. Up next in the Athletic Baseball Show feed is going to be Derek Van Riper and Keith Law on Friday. We got at least a couple more episodes of our labor show. We're going to run it probably through the end of this month. Not sure yet if we're going to keep it going into January. The lockout might keep going. One way or another, we'll have you covered. And for now, I'll see you next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. $50, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.